Okay, well, welcome to Politics Galore with me, Andrew Jackson. And David's not able to join us right now. He might be able to join us later, which will probably prove a challenge to the technology because we're not on a system where you can just pop in to the recording. But never mind. We might have to stop and bring him in. But anyway, nevertheless, we have a guest. I'm returning to the podcast once again. Very happy to say we have Alistair Stewart. Welcome, Alistair.
How are you doing?
Good, very well, thanks. And I know you've been a bit off colour, so we've discussed that offline. I won't share that with the listeners, but you're pretty much better now, better enough to be on the podcast anyway, which is great. And I'm just going to kick off with our user question. What's been on your mind when it comes to Scottish politics recently?
A very grand opening statement, I would say. Scotland's future. Attended last night the Our Scottish Future launch with Gordon Brown of the new pretty much alliance to transform the UK. And headlining it was Gordon Brown himself, Mark Drakeford, and others. It was a very interesting event, and it is nice to see, I suppose, two things happen concurrently. One, the SNP lean away from independence every week as an answer to everything, right, but also quite a fire in the belly Gordon Brown drive home the point that the United Kingdom is not quite finished yet. There is more to do, but it will require quite a concentrated effort to do that. And this follows a bit of press this week, particularly from Mr. Drakeford talking about a social union that needs to take the place of the political union that is the United Kingdom, which I thought was a bit flowery when I read it this week, because this kind of stuff is quite common. But hearing these guys speak, it got me thinking. If there was a downside to the event yesterday, it's these ideas obviously need more meat on the bone. And cynic in me, and the cynics among us, will say that, well, we've been around this particular roundabout before with federal United Kingdom, abolish the House of Lords, cement in law and writing social rights within the United Kingdom, that is to say, what each of the participating nations get out of it, to try and tackle the centralization of power in London, and altogether a feeling that not everyone is represented equally, both at the individual level, the nationwide level, and in England, the regional level, a point that Andy Burnham made very eloquently last night as well. So, yeah, two pretty concurrent thoughts, and it's very easy to say this. I don't want to sound cynical, particularly on approaching the weekend, but yeah, we've done this before. It's just that was the first time in a while that I've heard the spark of innovation have a real chance of just inspiring people and maybe keep the momentum up with this. But we need much, much more in terms of policy to deliver it. Otherwise, it's just another headline.
Yeah, okay. So did the SNP participate then, you said, in this event?
No, this was exclusively, it was quite Labour heavy, actually. Right. I note that Willie Rennie was there, but he wasn't speaking.
All right. Okay.
But I suppose there's two different tracks of thinking there. It's one, this is a completely separate event. It's something that is happening in civic life. And then you've got, politically, nationally, the sort of woes of the SNP and FNQs happening same day yesterday, of course, and Humza Yousaf he's talking about independence, but it feels much more like a box ticking exercise now from than an actual obsession, I suppose, is the word, as it was for Nicola Sturgeon near the end of her time in office. So it's going to be very interesting to see if these two things can meet in the middle and inspire an acceptance, I suppose, is the word, that independence is off the table for quite a while. But if you want it, there is an opportunity to work and try and transform the United Kingdom. Make devolution work. make it better. It's kind of been, that phrase has been done to death, and we need some real constitutional tweaking. Rewiring was the word that was going around, buzzing around in the air last night, and I think that's the correct one.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's because we haven't gone through some of the historical processes that other countries have got, that we have ended up with the complete guddle when it comes to the constitutional landscape in the UK. And it is, I mean, if it was a topography, it would all be completely uneven in terms of powers devolved and who has what responsibility. You've got a mayor here and no mayor there, and a big council here and a tiny one there, and this, that, and the other. And it is a complete mess, and it doesn't work. And I suppose, really, as effectively as it could. And I think one of the interesting things about it, of course, is, you know, people say, oh, no voter gets excited about constitutional reform. But I think, apart from people in Scotland, you know, arguing about independence, but I mean, with constitutional reform within the settlement, even keen people can be bored by it. But I think what most folk don't understand, or not because of any inability, just because they haven't bothered looking into it because it's not very exciting, is that, you know, a lot of things that could be done better can be done better because of changes to the setup that delivers them. And I'm not talking about public services, I'm talking about the democratic setup. You know, if I mean, I know Leslie Riddick's mad keen on devolving power way, way down to a small community level, and she says that in Scandinavia, you know, things are demonstrably better because of that, you know, and people, and I think in Britain we've got an obsession with, you know, all we can see is some, well, basically that, you know, like that video of that council with Jackie what's the face on it, you know, where everybody's, it's a bunch of little Englanders bickering about things like you know, parking bays, throwing their weight around in a sort of petty bureaucratic dead end. And that's what people think, oh god, that's the last thing we want. But of course, one of the interesting things about have such entities, no, let's say smaller entities having more power, is that it will attract better, more capable people. Because one of the reasons such entities at the moment have such difficulty getting people involved is because they don't really have anything useful to do. You know, they haven't got any power, they haven't got any real decision making. So why would you bother? Whereas if, you know, you're in control of some stuff, I mean, of course it'd attract the wrong kind of people because politics always does, but it's a bit sort of in with the bricks. But I think that's interesting. And
We are so cynical.
But well, I
think you're absolutely correct with that point, that we've kind of made the chatter about constitutional reform, the reform in itself, that all we can really do is change the messaging. But it actually needs a sweeping change. And the sweeping change, I suppose, this is the absolute nexus issue for voters, is how does it affect me? What you're talking about transforming countries, you're talking about adding another layer, or you're removing this, whatever. But the reality of it is that most people on a day-to-day level are affected by what some might determine to be terribly unsexy topics like bins and roads. But they're vital. They're absolutely, absolutely vital. I've mentioned this to you before, but the one thing that I would love to see in this country is having councillors up and down Scotland as full-time roles. And I think that if that was introduced, given that the competencies that, say, a local authority like Edinburgh has at the minute, that to me, it seems a necessary step, given the challenges that the city, never mind the country, that the city faces, the competencies it has. And then simultaneously, you've got people calling for local authorities to have more power and more responsibility. But the fundamental issue, it seems, that if you want to have councillors with the time and the ability to deliver for their constituents, they need to be remunerated to do so. They need to be remunerated competitively. And that will give them an opportunity to dedicate themselves full time to the challenges that one local authority like Edinburgh faces, to say nothing of Aberdeen and Glasgow.
Yeah. I think there's a lot to that. And I mean, one of the interesting things about this kind of debate is that I think in Britain, I think this is probably true because it's certainly true in America. There's an element of this in the independence debate. There's a nagging feeling that far away people in a sort of glamorous capital are more cosmopolitan and able than you are, than not you, Alistair, but like that one is, like I am, whatever. And therefore, they're probably the best people to run things because, oh my God, look what happens at my local level, you know. And I don't know where that comes from because it's not actually borne out by the facts. But if you think about, I mean, one of the most interesting example of this to me is the abortion debate in America, where people were horrified at the note, because what listeners may not understand is that the Supreme Court decision was not that abortion should be banned. It was that states should decide on abortion policy. at the local democratic level, which is a bit like councils deciding on it. In the nearest thing we could possibly have is councils deciding on it in, or you could argue the Scottish Parliament, but let's just stick with that example at the moment. And the reason they were horrified was because they thought, oh my Christ, a bunch of rednecks are going to ban abortion in those crazy redneck states. It's a disaster, right? Which basically is a tantamount to saying, and they're going to screw up everything else as well, because look at them, the horrible people, you know, even though in those states, those people have won elections, and people will talk about, you know, gerrymandering or whatever and vote rigging. But, you know, generally speaking, some states just swing very in America, swing very much to the right. But the point is that this idea of federalism, you know, it devolves a huge amount of power to the states, in fact. And it does lead to a postcode lottery. Abortion's a good example of that. And yet in Britain, we are absolutely obsessed with the idea that there should be no such thing as a postcode lottery. And I think what we need to do is, in the debate, is try to find a way round that while at the same time accepting that certain things will be necessarily different. I think people always think of a postcode lottery as somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. And to a certain extent, that's true. But if you conceive of it in those terms, but, you know, the bottom line is and let's just take an easy example. You simply cannot have a huge central hospital in the Highlands as you can in Glasgow, because far too many people are far too far away from it. You know, so you have to deliver service differently. And that's not quite the same thing as a postcode lottery, because what you try to do is achieve equality of outcomes rather than, in terms of public services, access to them and all that kind of thing, rather than the exact model. But the problem is that there's inevitably going to be some of that. But the truth is, there already is, you know, because there's just things like, you know, I mean, things like that are provided for in one city that aren't provided for in another. That's partly to do with the economy of the city as much as it is any democratic decision-making process. You know, I mean, so let's take a silly example, right? There's lots of comic shops in a big city compared to none in you know, a rural area. And that's just because of the economy. So there's a postcode lottery in different ways already outside of public services. So unfortunately, that's a very difficult conversation to have. But I do, the other thing I was thinking of, I'll let you come back in just a sec, was that, I mean, I suppose you asked the question, you know, how do you affect this kind of reform? And the bottom line is, I suppose, that if the Labour Party accepts that it's not going to win every single election in forever in perpetuity after this next one, which it will probably win, what it might consider doing is just, like it did with the NHS, is just introducing fundamental change that's effectively irreversible, which solves some of these problems. And that would include let's just take an easy example. I mean, I know, actually, I think Ian Dunt, who's a political commentator, was arguing against this abolition of the House of Lords recently, because he said it's one of the few parts of government that actually works, even though it shouldn't. It does, you know. Let's say they say, well, we're just going to abolish House of Lords. It's gone, right? It would be difficult to reinstate it in its form as it currently exists if the Tories won the following election. So that could be one. But what they could think of is trying to also give people things, you know, give people power, give people the capacity to make decisions, devolve things down. And you said, you know, what the voter will ask, what will I get out of it? And they could demonstrate, they could say, you know, you will get better transport in your area because now we've allowed councils to buy the bus service, for example, you know, just for example. And then it's always very hard to take things away from people once you've given. So as soon as the Tories get in, if they say, well, we're going to, I mean, they could say, well, we're going to be privatised. But if things were demonstrably better, I mean, Edinburgh's bus service, which is owned by the council, is immeasurably better than pretty much every other bus service in the UK. So it can work. So that could be their way of thinking about it. You know, let's try and entrench some stuff here that the Tories really can't unpick easily. And that then encourage a momentum behind further reform, which even the Tories might take on in due course. Don't know whether you think that's a goer.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The federalism, I suppose some reform does need to happen. That the UK is fundamentally unequal to its core. And any institution, say the House of Lords or the House of Commons, whatever, all of them will find some justification to extend their existence. That is the nature of political power. That seems a historical truism. And if you're talking about getting rid of something, fair enough, the argument and the onus is on people to make the case for why that is a good decision and really how it should be done, what needs to be achieved and what that roadmap is. That's something that's been sorely missing, I think, from certainly since devolution, actually, that people have done away with roadmaps and timescales and PowerPoint presentations for, right, we want to achieve independence. Well, what's phase one? Stuff like that. But I think coming back to it, what you're saying, you're right. There is, there will always be, I suppose, a grass is greener on the other side distribution of public services. There will always be some unequal distribution given location, say Edinburgh versus the Highlands. You can try and deal with that and handle that. It's a question of who handles it and when. My one concern about this, I suppose, leaning into the federal answer to everything, is what I remember. It came up on my Facebook feed quite recently, but it was former Justice Scalia. He was talking about how he went into this incredibly, I don't even know what it was, but this incredibly eloquent defense of the Constitution, and everyone is terribly excited about the Bill of Rights. And I suppose we can come onto that and talk about social rights as a comparison that UK is trying to introduce. But the Constitution, the whole reason it works, that the American model works, is not the separation of powers that everyone likes to think about, but is the stalemate, or the quote-unquote, this is his words, the quote-unquote gridlock it produces. Gridlock is good, he says. Gridlock isn't, the minorities are protected, his words, that you don't want governments to do too much, you want them to do just enough, and you need to have more of it, you need to have it separated. But the ultimate achievement is the process of gridlock, because gridlock has become a dirty word, and that we should embrace it as positive. It kind of blew my socks off that, because I felt right, at least honest about it. And it was an interesting way of seeing it, I suppose, because for years everyone says that, you know, the American model could never work because, you know, the European versions of parliamentary democracy are faster, they're more efficient and all the rest of it. But gridlock is something to look forward to and aspire to, is a good thing. And it got me thinking that in terms of the United Kingdom, how do we, I suppose, strike a balance between having legislation brought forward, that some of it, and I think we all know what some good examples of it are, but some of it's brought forward for the sake of it, and then some of it is genuinely transformative. And you get examples of that at the Scottish Parliament, of course you do, get examples at the House of Commons, but you also get decisions at a local level, which might seem incredibly punitive, but in some cases it is radical in its scope and scale. So I suppose the question is, how do you tie the hands of some legislators who are doing too much, but also liberate the ones that need to be doing more? And to me, that the answer to that is simply that a lot of talk about giving local councils more powers, that's again another one that's been going on for years and has materialized in some ways but disappointed in others. It starts with the time element, and you have to ask that, would it be better if you had some part-time MSPs and full-time councillors? Is that something that we could seriously put on the table to discuss?
We've got some part-time MSPs already, I think.
no comment, but I suppose it's just making work more efficient, and where all this talk of transforming institutions and all the rest of it is necessary and is correct, but look at the record of what these bodies do. And to me, full-time councillors would be a seismic change to the political landscape of Scotland as independence itself. A bold statement, but I would love to see Edinburgh after a full council term with full-time councillors, and what that would look like. I think it would speed up a lot of issues, and it would speed up a lot of issues in other parts of the country too.
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, it's obviously very, very unpopular with the public. But as I say, it goes back to this point I made earlier that, you know, people can't assess the benefits of these kind of things. And it's for politicians and others to demonstrate that to them. But I think to a certain extent, there are things, and this is a disease that infects politics generally. But I find it, I know most about the, you know, Scotland and the UK, is that politicians these days, they don't really have, this don't seem to have much of a vision, you know. I mean, things like Our Scottish Future might qualify as a vision, but it's not a vision like the post-war vision, or even and that, you know, the visions of parties that have sort of extended further past the end of the war, and maybe they lost their way a bit eventually. But, you know, I mean, Thatcher had a vision, you might not like it, but she had one. It wasn't all as smoothly delivered, in fact, as people looking back on it think it was, but, you know, it was there. And I think that's one of the problems, because only with that kind of thing is there any impetus to coming up with the detail. Because, as you say, you know, Our Scottish Futures, you know, let's say they describe it as a vision, you know, that, but you said they need more policies underneath it. I mean, independence is a vision, you know, you could argue that's certainly a vision. But at the same time, apart from the 600-page doorstopper that they printed up in 2014, which didn't answer all the questions, there's very little beneath that either, you know. I mean, let's take the currency question, you know. Make a decision, right? Make a decision. Just decide what you're going to do about currency. You know, if you hear people saying, well, they did it in, I don't know, Estonia and it all went fine. Great. Well, then let's have our own currency. Just tick that box, you know, instead of this constant, oh, I don't really know, you know, which isn't doing the independence movement any favors if you support it, you know. But that's not my point. My point is, you know, if you come up with a detail under these things, and then you've got a chance of delivering the vision, in the same way that, you know, governments of the past have delivered certain changes. But, you know, politicians don't want to engage with that kind of thing because, frankly, it's too difficult. And it's frustrating when you work in policy. So sometimes, you know, you read things like, you read a strategy, okay, and you think, okay, well, this is supposed to be high level, but, you know, whatever, it's kind of really high level, you know, jam tomorrow, the clean air for all, or whatever, you know. And then you read something like the delivery plan or the action plan, and you're like, right, this doesn't actually have any actions in it, you know, or delivery in it, you know. And it's still all we will consider scoping the potential to, and all that kind of stuff, you know, classic civil service language. Or it's written in things you can't quantify or easily measure. And there are some exceptions to that. I mean, in terms of the Scottish government, the one I know a little bit about is that the mental health strategy was at one point actually assessed against quite a long list of indicators to see how well it was going. But that's rare. And in terms of both governments and actually the policy and public affairs profession, we're very good at calling for things and then being happy when they happen. But we're much worse at assessing whether they've actually worked. You know, and when you look at, I mean, Stephen Boyd at Audit Scotland is obviously having a whale of a time, because every day he gets up and says, right, who's screwed up worse today that I can berate in Moe videos and write a report in barely believable prose about how little information is connected to discover whether the strategy has worked or how terrible everything's going. Or, I mean, I joke, you know, it's not really very funny, I suppose. But, you know, one of the things that's breathtaking about the Audit Scotland reports, which I appreciate are not, you know, most people don't read them, is just how impossible it is for Audit Scotland to actually understand whether anything is working. You know, if they criticise the level of transparency or the lack of information coming from government, then there's no hope for the rest of us. I mean, the budget, we were chatting about this the other day, the budget is a classic example of nobody can figure out what that's all about, apart from the people who actually put it together. There's not enough information out there to anyone to really know where money's going. Apart from in the billions and millions and stuff like that. But there's lots of other things as well that there's just lack of information about. I think I can't remember which strategy it was, but essentially Audit Scotland just said, look, it's impossible. We can't tell. There's no information, end of story, you know. And it's one policy error, which is outrageous, because, you know, surely government would want to know whether it was doing well or badly, because if it happens to be doing well, and sometimes it does do well, they want to say, look, how well we're doing, instead of saying, well, we've lashed out £1 billion on this, but we've no idea whether it's working. I mean, I was joking the other day, I think the greatest achievement of any Scottish government in recent times is the Queensferry crossing, because you can see that there's a working bridge. Everyone can see and go, oh, look, it's a bridge, it's new and it works, you know, I can go across it. And there's loads more things there, and that's a complex endeavor, obviously, to build a bridge. But there's many more policies issues that are frankly much more complicated, really, that nobody knows whether things are working or not. So gone off at a wee tangent there, but I agree with your point about there needs to be much more detail underneath these things.
You touch on something really interesting, and I suppose the question mark is when did destination and vision become so conflated? That is to say, independence is the destination. That's what we want. This is what we are working towards this is the answer to all ills. And I'm not being glib about this, but that's very different to a vision of independence. And I suppose the vision of independence would require everything that has not come out in the last 10 years. So you had that 600-page white paper for independence, but it lacked the kind of visionary detail for what this would work and look like in application. And the interesting part of that, I suppose, is that if you are to describe a vision to people, you have to acknowledge the challenges, the dangers, and the pitfalls, and give a reality that is both uplifting, but not all saccharine rubbish that people just don't buy it. There's been none of that in Scottish politics for quite a while. You've got two destinations. You've got independence, or you've got Remain in the United Kingdom, but there's very little of, I don't know, I suppose an exciting vision for either, a real working model. There used to be a time where it was government for government's sake. That is, you get into power for the sake of getting into power, but you also govern because that is what you need to do. This injection of grandiose sweeping tomorrows is a relatively new thing in British politics, I suppose. The Americans have had it for a while. George Bush famously said the vision thing. But I suppose we just need to get it in context in Scotland. We need, if we're going to go down this route of talking about great tomorrows and all the rest, or continue going down this route of great tomorrows and great visions, whether it be reforming the United Kingdom or achieving Scottish independence, whatever one you want, that there must be more meat on the bone. There really has to be. There's only so much that people can take of this. Yeah. I'm very old-fashioned with this, is that I really think that this is my sort of litmus test. The day that I know that Scottish independence is an inevitable reality will be the day that the First Minister, whoever they may be, goes on national television and has a pie chart and has a PowerPoint presentation and is standing there in a suit and tie with one of those little laser pens and just going slide by slide saying, right, phase one is going to take 2 to 3 years. Phase two is going to take 5 to 10. And then phase three, you'll, you know, see a return on your investment. I know it sounds horribly facetious, but that absence of explaining things to people in a phased way for these sweeping constitutional changes and all the rest of it, that's why they get turned off to it. They think it's either just nonsense and a lot of hot air, or they think that the people putting forward these ideas across the political divide are not serious enough to phase it. Yeah. So Hamza's talking about independence, or Gordon Brown is indeed talking about, say, abolishing the House of Lords and replacing it with the Senate. All of these things, fine, great solutions to whoever it is that you're appealing to, but there must be, I suppose, another level of that. We have to call these guys to a higher level of detail if we're going to get out of this quagmire of suppose hot air, really, about where we're at and where we're going.
Well, that's right, and I think that, you know, the weirdest thing about independence and talking about vision and independence, vision and a destination, you know, is that many people who support the independence movement, not all of them, but many of them, do think it's all about ushering in the promised land. And yet there can be no guarantees about what happens after independence if Scotland goes independent. Now, some people will argue, well, Scots are much nicer, so we'll have a lovely society. And then at the same time, you see them arguing on Twitter about the Rangers-Celtic game, and you think, well, maybe not so nice in some circumstances. You know, so this idea that we're some sort of chosen people, that's a little nonsense. You know, I mean, Scots are very much like lots of other countries and with divisions. And we did have a very interesting conversation once with a Swedish professor on the podcast where we were discussing what lessons there might be for an independent Scotland in Sweden, where the right wing has risen very unexpectedly because of a complacency about the nature of Swedish society on the part of the left. You know, just, oh, we're all great people, it's never going to happen. Suddenly they're in government, you know, and you know, that kind of thing is there. So You know, it's a tabula rasa. You know, you've got people on the right who, like bankers, who think, great, we'll be Scotland, Singapore on the Clyde, you know, and then you've got people on the left who think, brilliant, North Korea on the war relief. You know, I mean, I'm exaggerating for effect, but you know what I mean? It's like, I'm being silly a bit, but you know, that's just, it's not fair, because one of the things that I always wonder about independence is what will happen when, not if, when it lets lots of its supporters down, if it comes, because it can only do that because it cannot possibly deliver the sort of, you know, the Jericho, was it Jericho? That I can't remember anyway, you know, the new Israel that some people think, I don't mean that in terms of the current state, I mean, in terms of the biblical vision, you know, that people think it's going to do, you know, I mean, you know, people genuinely think we're going to have some sort of benefit system that will, you know, be miles better and more generous and more humane than the UK one. And then once independence happens, and the part, whichever party says, right, great, we're going to have that system. Here's your massive tax rise, everybody. People go, well, wait a minute. I didn't realise that was how it was going to work. You know, because Scots are very averse, despite what they say, to paying more taxes. I think there was a ridiculous report in the Times of Scotland that said, well, a third of the country would consider leaving Scotland if taxes were risen too high. 1.8 million people. I thought, where are they going to go? They can't go to Europe without permission. You know, they're going to emigrate in a fleet of ships. Absolutely ridiculous. But and that's all nonsense, of course. People aren't going anywhere. You know, they never do. Lots of people go, oh, I'm leaving if that happens. And then they realise what that actually means. And they think, oh, I can't, even if I want it to. So it's crazy. Anyway, that's us up to time. Have you got any final remarks, Alistair, before we sign off for this week?
Only to say that I think that the biggest, we're kind of reaching reaching a very interesting apex point in the sort of dominance of the SNP and what comes next. And you are seeing, as all things, a decline in the SNP and I suppose a shifting independence to a not back burner topic, but certainly lessening the intensity around the messaging with it. It's the onus is on opposition parties to come up with the vision and the vision thing anyone can do. The hard part is providing quantifiable, qualifiable details. And details are not always sexy, but they are reliable. And if we're serious about transforming the United Kingdom, if we're serious about trying to improve the lot of everyone, it's going to require a scope and scaling and a degree of nuance that we've not seen for a while. And I really, really hope that that's delivered. I was thinking that was my key reflection last night on the Irish Scottish Future event and what Gordon Brown, who had real fire in his belly with this, Mark Drakeford as well. If they're going to do it, they need to keep the momentum up. But details, details, details.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Okay, well, on that note, we will sign off. Thank you very much indeed, Alistair, for being our guest this week. I hope folk enjoyed that. I always enjoy having Alistair on as a guest. And we will see you next time. Cheers. Bye-bye.